Welcome, everyone. I am Bob Wurzelbacher, the director of the Respect Life Office for the Archdiocese of Cincinnati, and this is our video podcast series that we call Being Pro-Life. Each month, we discuss a different topic in the Respect Life arena. We'll hear a personal story from someone deeply affected by that issue, and finally, we'll share ways that you can get involved. This month, we're going to talk about how to get involved on the local, state, federal, and even international efforts in the Respect Life movement, especially as it relates to abortion. So as always, this week, we have a special guest. Will you please introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Tom McCluskey. I'm Vice President of Government Affairs for March for Life.
So Tom, let's start. Let's get you a little background on you. How did you come to be in the position you are for Fighting for Life there in Washington, D.C.?
Nobody in Washington, D.C. is usually from Washington, D.C. And I grew up in a rural town in upstate New York and came down to D.C. after getting a political science degree because I figured there's not enough of those down here in D.C. And did some work for George H.W. Bush and did some work in what would be called the real world. We worked for a tax organization and worked for an oil company. And then decided I wanted to go to, I usually joke, wanted to work for less controversial issues. So I went to Family Research Council to work on the life issues and marriage issues and religious liberty issues. And then the March for Life, if you're familiar with it, I usually describe it as a 47-year-old brand new organization. It was founded by Nellie Gray in 1973, a woman like no other, except she ran it for over 40 years out of her living room in her Capitol Hill house. When she passed away, Jeannie Mancini was asked to make the organization a year-round organization. And a year later, Jeannie asked me to come on to help revive the C4 at March for Life so that we could give all those marches. We have hundreds of thousands of marchers coming every year. And the question is always, what's next? And we want to answer that question by becoming a year-round organization and helping point them in the right direction. It's not necessarily made to the March for Life. One of the pleasures of the pro-life movement, we have so many great allies, the Family Research Council, Susan B. Anthony List, National Rights to Life, Concerned Women for America, Live Action, Students for Life. I mean, there are just so many that we like to think that if you come to us and you have a pro-life concern, hopefully we can point you in the right direction. Unlike others in Washington, we don't like to say we have all the answers. We'll just point you to the people who do.
All right, Tom. Well, thank you so much for spending time with us today. So let's get started with some of the bills that have happened, perhaps recently, maybe that have passed or that are currently in the Senate or in the legislature that are related to Respect Life issues.
Certainly. I have to tell you about the last 6 or 7 months, I've been wondering which exact level of Dante's Hades I've been on. The House of Representatives has gone nonstop in passing legislation that affects the life issue.
Right.
Some of the big ones that none of the pro-life groups are talking about are, of course, the Equality Act, which while its main purpose is to focus on gender identity and gender dysphoria, in fact, also goes after the life issues, making it practically illegal to be pro-life either on the state or federal level. You would have to explain yourself to the Department of Justice if you wanted to pass a Down syndrome bill or parental consent bill. In addition, the Equal Rights Amendment, something that originally began by pro-lifers back when the women's suffrage movement was, a lot of the women suffragists were pro-life. Unfortunately, over time, especially in the 60s, the Equal Rights Amendment evolved into something that is more promoting abortion. This also passed the House with all Democratic votes and currently sits in the Senate, as does the Equality Act. And those are two pieces of legislation that we're focusing on and trying to make sure that there, at least that there are a couple of Democrats who support us as well. In addition, there's campaign finance legislation that was passed by the House, which supposedly is to look at the current turmoil that we have with elections. But in fact, it does a lot to curtail the First Amendment, especially the First Amendment of those who disagree with those currently in charge. It would expose a lot of pro-life organization donors to public retribution, as well as limit the amount of contact that grassroots could have with their state legislators. That if a group like March for Life were to ask somebody in Ohio to contact their senator on the, say, the Equality Act, if S1, the Senate bill, were to pass, those grassroots activists would first have to register with the federal government before contacting their senator. And that is not how the democracy should work.
That's interesting. You know what? Before you move on too much, can we back up just a little bit? So more specifically about the Equality Act then, for example, I know that's the biggest one in the news. It's sitting right now in the Senate. Maybe a little bit more detail for those that might be not so familiar with it. How is it that it's affecting abortion so much?
Well, there's a provision within the Equality Act that was added, I believe, last Congress that focuses around a woman's right in pregnancy, something that we would all agree with. However, most courts have said that when that language has been used in other pieces of legislation, that that would allow for abortion and that there should be no restrictions when it comes to abortion. And no restrictions would mean that federal funding would have to go towards it, that state laws that might, if the Department of Justice were to think that state laws inhibited a woman's right to abortion, then they would be able to step in and overrule or perhaps prosecute any state that would pass such laws.
Right.
It's not something that's very well known because most people do focus on the gender expression part and the gender dysphoria part. However, it is something that pro-life groups like us and SBA List and National Rights to Life have tried to highlight, especially with U.S. senators who might not have any problem with some of that other stuff. But when it comes to the life issue, they are definitely pro-life.
Right. What about conscience protections? Does that hurt conscience protections as well? The Equality Act?
It would hurt conscience protections. If you're a healthcare professional who believes that life begins at conception, something that science also agrees with, and you don't want to participate in an abortion, you could be forced to participate in an abortion. We saw a lot of this over the years. In the last administration, Trump administration, HHS sought to protect a lot of those people. There was a nurse up in New Hampshire that was forced to participate in an abortion. And there's also churches, both evangelical and Catholic churches out in California, that the California state government was trying to force to pay for abortions through their healthcare plans. All of that would be allowed under a Biden administration.
Yeah, we spoke with, well, it wasn't that one, now I forget the name, but we spoke with a nurse from New York State who had a lot to do with that being forced to have an abortion and the Trump administration put that protection in place for healthcare workers. But do you believe the Equality Act would take all that away?
Some of the authors of the bill have specifically pointed to cases like in California and the New York case as well, that the Equality Act would help them. Help is the wrong word to say, except to help them make sure that healthcare professionals would force healthcare professionals to participate in abortions, whether they want to or not.
Right. We don't have to address this if you don't want to, but I think that when same-sex marriage was legalized or became the law, then many Catholic adoption agencies had to close. There are a few that I believe are still fighting this in the courts, being able to stay open and only place children into heterosexual coupled homes. Is the Equality Act going to have anything to do with that? You think make it even harder for them to make that case that they should be able to stay open and not be considered discriminatory for only wanting to place children in heterosexual married homes?
Well, the March for Life doesn't take a position on such on these issues. I ran the Government Affairs Department for the Family Research Council for over a decade. So I'm certainly familiar with a lot of these issues, and especially with the way that they're affecting Catholic charities. The Equality Act, when it comes to those issues, is actually much stronger. There would probably be very little litigation because the legislation is very clear that you would not get any government funds or any government assistance unless you follow the government's rules and placed children in homes that your faith might disagree with.
Right. Are there other conscience protections related to the Equality Act that immediately come to mind that we'd also probably ought to be concerned about?
Not the Equality Act as much as some of the actions within the Biden administration already.
Ah, sure.
It's the Trump administration, to their great credit, created a whole agency within HHS to protect the conscience rights of individuals.
Right. I remember that.
Especially during the COVID time. They really stepped up. And when it comes to people with disabilities and healthcare professionals, it sought to protect the conscience rights. That agency has now gone silent, and I wouldn't be surprised if the Biden administration were to scrap it. And also enforcement of laws that are on the books. The California cases I talked about with the Catholic churches and the Christian churches is something the Weldon Amendment, which has been part of U.S. law for the last about 30, 40 years, except the Obama administration ignored the Weldon Amendment and the Trump administration actually enforced. We expect that the Biden administration will go back to ignoring it, allow the Catholic churches to be persecuted out in California and the Christian churches as well. And we would expect other states to follow suit. I know New York is talking about similar legislation as well as Michigan.
I'm not familiar with the Weldon Amendment. I'm sorry about that. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Within federal legislation, appropriations, which is annual legislation, which allows where your taxpayer money is going to be spent, there are pro-life provisions within them that have to be renewed annually every year. One of them is the Weldon Amendment, which seeks to protect the conscience of healthcare professionals. Unfortunately, though, with the Weldon Amendment, a great piece of legislation, however, it leaves it up to HHS and DOJ to decide if the Weldon Amendment, if your conscience has been violated. And it leaves no civic path for somebody whose conscience has been violated to follow. But more familiar provisions or riders, they're also called pro-life riders, would be the Helms Amendment, which prohibits federal funding of abortions, as well as the Hyde Amendment, which prevents federal funding of abortions domestically through the Medicare program.
And the Biden administration is trying to take both of those away?
They would like to see both of them go away. The bigger fear is that they are passing legislation to make them obsolete. The Hyde Amendment is very specific for taxpayer funds going through the Medicare program, that they not be used for abortions. However, starting with Obamacare, except now with the latest COVID relief bill that Joe Biden and the Democrats passed, there are billions of dollars being pushed through the healthcare plans that are not subject to the Hyde Amendment, thus meaning that taxpayers are subsidizing abortions currently, including, as weird as it might sound, if you work on Capitol Hill, if you're a staffer on Capitol Hill, and your healthcare is paid almost exclusively by federal taxpayers, you can have a healthcare plan that pays for abortions. This totally ignores current law, except we don't expect the Biden administration to enforce the laws that are on the books when it's something to their advantage.
Now, you brought up the new division of the HHS that the Trump administration put forth in order to protect religious freedoms. You said, I was going to ask you about that. You said that it's silent right now and you wouldn't be surprised if it was scrapped by the Biden administration. So it's still there. Is it run by the same people? Did he have, I have no idea. Is it part of what Biden was able to put somebody else in charge of it? Or
no, it's what's called political positions, and political positions switch with every new president.
Right.
The person who headed up the Civil Rights Division under HHS under President Trump was a guy named Roger Severino, and he was just fantastic on the issue. He's currently with the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and his main task is to oversee just exactly what the Biden HHS plans on doing. The Biden administration has not appointed anybody else to take over that position. But one thing here at the March that we've concentrated a lot on is personnel. Personnel is policy, is our philosophy. And look at some of the people he's put at HHS. Javier Becerra, the new secretary of HHS, he had no healthcare experience prior to becoming the secretary of health for the entire nation. He was the attorney general for the state of California. And those cases I mentioned before, the California cases, include and also cases involving pregnancy care centers where they were being forced to promote abortions, he was the main pusher of those cases going through the court system. He was the attorney general for California. He's such an abortion zealot. He also filed cases in other states like Alabama were trying to push pro-life legislation. Underneath him, there's a person called Rachel Levine, who is Pennsylvania Secretary of Health. Rachel Levine, we talked earlier about gender dysphoria. This person is someone who suffers from gender dysphoria. But Dr. Levine is also somebody who, in the state of Pennsylvania, worked diligently to fight against pro-life laws and was key in getting a bill that were to protect Down syndrome children vetoed by that governor. Andrea Palm, who hasn't had a vote yet, someone else who has no healthcare experience. However, she was Secretary of Health for the state of Michigan, is also someone who doesn't believe in conscience. She's been overruled numerous times by the state Supreme Court. And in addition, she was very much an advocate for abortion, even bringing Planned Parenthood staff onto her staff when she was back in her home state. And we expect her to do the same if she gets confirmed for HHS.
So I know how positioning works. Back to the Equality Act, that passed the House quite some time ago. And now it's sitting in the Senate. It's wire to wire, you know, Democrats and Republicans there in the Senate. You figure it's not going to go to a vote, right, until the majority leader thinks it's going to go his way, I would imagine. And this has to do with one or two Democrats. What's that story?
Right. I'm going to try to explain Senate rules. And anybody who tells you they're an expert on Senate rules is lying to you. Senate rules is kind of like Calvin Ball, if you remember from the Calvin and Hobbes cartoon.
Yes, actually, I do.
Seems like right when you think you understand it, the rules change. But currently, to get most pieces of legislation through, you need 60 votes. unless you go through a budget process called reconciliation. Something like the Equality Act cannot go pass through reconciliation. So it needs 60 votes.
Okay.
However, if the Democratic majority in the Senate decided to change the rules of the Senate, rules that have existed since it began, it actually used to take unanimous consent to get legislation to the floor. And that's changed over time. And in the last century, it evolved into you need 60 votes. However, if the Democratic majority and the Democratic majority leader, Chuck Schumer, decide that we want to change the rules so that we only need a simple majority to pass legislation, then that is the big fear for a number of Republicans right now and for a number of pro-lifers, because it's very rare that we have a majority. We might have a Republican majority in the Senate sometimes. It's very rare there are a pro-life majority in the Senate. So right now, there's a lot of eyes and a lot of Republicans that are cozying up to Democrats, such as Joe Manchin, who though he hasn't voted pro-life, certainly describes himself as pro-life, and Kristen Sinema from Arizona, Joe Manchin's from West Virginia. They have a lot of people now talking to them from across the aisle, trying to make sure that they stay firm on the Senate rules.
Right. Well, are the odds of that fairly good that they might try that, given how the rules on how to confirm a justice, you know, were changed a few years ago to the simple majority?
Both parties, though, have looked at what is called the legislative filibuster. You were talking about the judicial filibuster, right. The legislative filibuster. It's different, even though it's, again, we're getting into arcane Senate rules. However, in my opinion, and I always say, if you're pro-life, you're automatically an optimist, because you believe in life and you believe right. The potential of every human life and the dignity of every human life. So I'm optimistic that we will be able to keep what is called the legislative filibuster. Doesn't mean we're not going to have to work hard to keep it, but I'm optimistic that we'll be able to keep it.
Right. So the Born Alive Protection Act, that keeps coming up every 2 years, of course, as well. Of course, we know that that would never pass in the current makeup of the legislature, you know, the House or the Senate, but where is that right now? Is it come up anyway for vote, or we're going to wait?
There are certain pieces of legislation you just have to keep on toiling at and keep on working at. And we saw that during the 1990s with the partial birth abortion ban, which then became law under President George W. Bush. With Born Alive legislation, we're going from arcane Senate rules now to arcane House rules. Anything that reaches the House floor, it's up to the Speaker. And the Speaker currently is pro-abortion, Speaker Nancy Pelosi from California. Right. However, there's one exception to that. And that is if you can get signatures of, I believe the number is of 217 members of Congress on a piece of legislation, that automatically forces it onto the floor for a vote. And this is what we're trying to do with the Born Alive bill. A brand new Congresswoman from Florida, Kat Kamak, is leading that up alongside Steve Scalise, who's the minority whip. He's from Illinois. And currently, I believe we are about 5 signatures short. Every Republican who's able to has signed the petition. There are a couple, I think, who are still out sick. Most notably, Congressman Dan Crenshaw, though I believe he's getting back into the swing of things. He just recently had eye surgery. Hmm. So we will only need 5 signatures. And the Born Alive bill is a perfect example of how to show the differences, I think, between those who claim they're pro-choice and those who are pro-life. This is a baby. It's no longer an abortion issue. We're getting an infanticide. This is a baby that is born alive. And all we're saying is that federal law dictates that if a baby survives an abortion, it deserves every medical attention that it could get. And the other side argues that's already law. It's not. And that's why there are numerous cases that we see in the states that prove the case that that is not the law, that most abortionists would leave that baby to perish on its own. So I think you'll see a lot of this in campaign ads. You'll see a lot of this discussion on the House floor and trying to convince just 5 Democrats to sign on to the petition. It is a lot harder because in this last election, 2 pro-life Democrats, Representative Dan Lipinski from Michigan and Colin Peterson, both lost their elections. For Dan Lipinski, he was primaried out because pro-abortion forces within the Democratic Party didn't like the fact that he was pro-life. So it's tough, except again, I'm an optimist, and I do think it gives us something positive to focus on, at least for the next year and a half, where pro-life is very much in the minority.
So what is the primary articulation against the Born Alive Protection Act? Is it because I think I've heard it's because they say it's just not necessary. Is that the argument? Or is there a deeper argument than that, that they say out loud, right? Of what they're...
The one they say out loud is that it's not necessary.
Except right, that's what I thought.
As we've seen in states that have passed their own Born Alive legislation, because prior to until the states pass this legislation, we don't even know the number of children who survive an abortion attempt. And in Florida, I believe for the most recent year, it might have been about a dozen children who have. So who knows how many in other states as well. But to me, if one child is surviving an abortion, this legislation is necessary.
Sure. And
so we need to make sure, because it's not in an abortionist's best interest, if a baby survives an abortion, to do everything it can to make sure that baby lives. So there was Born Alive legislation passed in the early 2000s. However, that was more of a descriptive language of describing what the situation is. There were no penalties within it. So there's nothing compelling the abortionist to actually do anything to help save the baby. What this current legislation does is to compel healthcare professionals to do all they can to save that baby.
Right. Yeah, I imagine that would, obviously, we both believe it's a baby, whether it's inside the womb or outside the womb, and it's killing, right, whether it's inside or outside the womb. Of course, that's where we are. But I guess it makes sense if you have this act and you make, apparently, I guess you would say you make a mistake, I suppose, in the abortion procedure, a baby's born alive, then you have to save that child, and that under those circumstances, and the doctor has to come back to the mother who was expecting to have an abortion and say, well, your baby's alive. I suppose that would be a difficult situation for that abortionist. Of course, the life of the child is more important than the embarrassment of the abortionist. But
in every case, and right, we're greatly helped currently. The Abortion Survivors Network is an organization actually formed to highlight these cases. And they've just got their first lobbyist now here in Washington, D.C. So it's kind of hard for the Democrats to say that this legislation isn't necessary when they're sitting across from somebody who benefits.
Right. I've heard talks from people. You know, there are some people out there who have survived abortions and they are grown up, and now they tell their story of like a nurse saved them, or, you know, stories like that. They're pretty compelling stories. What else do we need to talk about?
I talked earlier about how to get bills passed without 60 votes, and that's something called a budget reconciliation.
Right.
We've seen already it used once with COVID relief. The actual COVID relief, only 9% of the legislation that passed in January or early February, only about 9% of that legislation actually went to actual COVID relief. However, it freed up billions of dollars for both national and international abortions and abortion organizations. Now there's an infrastructure bill that the Democrats are indicating they want to pass through the same way, meaning they only need 50 votes. And that would be 50 Democrats, and then Kamala Harris would be the 51st vote, the vice president. And the infrastructure bill is already, it's not even drafted yet, except the Biden administration has made clear they want at least $200 billion to be dedicated to expanding Obamacare state programs. A lot of these programs, which taxpayer funds help subsidize healthcare plans that pay for abortions. This is probably going to be a lot of what we're concentrating on the national level, trying to educate, because once you, as I mentioned, and if I haven't put people to sleep already, once you start talking about the rules up in Congress, it's a little harder to message on, except it comes down very simply, abortion is not healthcare. However, that is what the COVID relief bill did, and that is what the infrastructure bill plans on doing.
All right, Tom. So do you have a website maybe you'd like to show, we could show on screen, or tell people to, if they want to get involved, they want to contact their senators, they want to know the issues that they need to be concerned about?
Certainly. We have two websites for both our C3 and our C4. One is Education Arm. The other is more concentrating legislation, which I do a lot more work with. Our C3 website is marchforlife.org. Pretty simple. And our C4 website, where you can find bios for a lot of Biden personnel, as well as action alerts on a lot of the legislation we talked about today, you can go to mflaction.org.
Okay, so we're showing the marchforlifeaction.org on the screen here. If you're listening to the podcast, again, mflaction.org or marchforlifeaction.org, both of those will get you right to that website. So tell us a little about what we can find on there and how we can, there's a donate button right there at the top.
Right. There's always that. Right there, you have the different alerts that we have going out. One is the discharge petition. One is about saving Hyde, a major concern. And another is find your legislators. One thing, if I may indulge a little bit and a little self-promotion, one thing that I started when I came to March for Life, it's something I got from some of our partners in the states, especially Washington State, is a lot of grassroots, they are intimidated or overwhelmed when they think about everything that's going on in their state legislatures or their federal legislatures. So we started something called Capitol Hill 101, which helps humanize the legislative process. It's even less about the issues and it's more about the office. Like when you're going to contact a member of Congress or go to meet with them, a lot of times you're going to meet with their staff. You're not going to meet with that member, but that's okay. And we try to walk people through meeting with their member of Congress and along those lines and little tidbits. Like if your member of Congress is in office and you want to meet with them, ask to take a picture with them, because no member of Congress is going to turn down getting a picture taken with them. So that's something we try to do. And you can find that in our educational resources as well. If you scroll down a little more, you'll find.
So you scroll down to pro-life legislation successes, and you can see some right. bios and some of the people. There we go. Okay. So for more information there. And then you can take action, right? You can right. contact your senator. Where do you do that? You can add your voice. Because there's an add your voice link. You can sign up for petitions right there. And there are places on that website where you can contact your legislators as things come up that you might want to ask them to vote on. Other things that we should be talking about, Tom?
As I said before, you can't be a pro-life if you're not an optimist. And I just do want to point out to people that in this last election, while a pro-life majority lost the Senate, lost the White House as well, we did gain a number of seats in the House. Currently, there are more pro-life women in the House of Representatives than there has been at any given time.
Wow.
I had the pleasure of sitting down and talking with a lot of these incoming freshmen, and they're ready and raring to go. They are not afraid to speak out on the life issue, which is just so great to see. So I'm optimistic. And the more involved we are, the more educated we are, I think, on the issues, the better our, I think we are when it comes to election days.
All right. Well, thanks, Tom, for talking with us today and sharing the story of your background and your work for March for Life. And the work that you do for women, for the unborn, and for the conscience rights of all Americans. Thanks for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me on, Bob. If any of your listeners do want to learn more, please feel free to contact me. And I also want to thank you for all the work that you do. As you know, my wife also works for the church, and it really is a calling. And it's the local activists such as yourself that really do the important work.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a pleasure. And I want to thank all of our viewers and listeners for tuning in on this episode of our Being Pro-Life series. Head to the website to view more resources talked about on this episode at www.catholicaoc.org/beingpro-life. Thank you again for joining us today. I look forward to being with you next time.